you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. Well, we are recording the evening of December 7th, 2021, which is the 80th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor raid, the raid that brought the United States officially into the Second World War, a decisive moment, one of the most decisive moments of that conflict. This was the war is often referred to as the Good War. I think there's a book by Studs Terkel by that name, how good was this war? It brought mass destruction, death to tens of millions of people, enormous suffering all around, and destruction of cities, probably the destruction of Europe as being an independent power. How could an event like that be called good? That description for that conflict, I think, stems from the portrayal in the standard historical accounts of the war as sort of a Manichaean struggle between the good allies versus the evil Axis powers. But it's a bit more complicated than that. I mean, the way the narrative is, you had the Japanese trying to create a coast prosperity sphere, its own empire in East Asia, the Third Reich, waging a brutal crusade for a new order in Europe, dominance of Europe, and a reaction to it. And so if you accept that official narrative, you can see how people see it as a good war, but it's more complicated than that. This view has persisted for more than 75 years, particularly in the United States. I mean, reinforced by countless motion pictures, TV shows, documentaries, and books. So this is just what most people kind of accepted. But let's suffice it to say that the Second World War, which was waged in the skies and oceans and the lands on five separate continents, involved 21 combatant nations, lasted 6 years, killed an average of 27,000 people a day. It was a much more complex and morally ambiguous event that is usually presented in the standard historical accounts. Now tonight, I have the pleasure of Mike King back on the show. He wrote a book challenging this narrative, appropriately titled book called The Bad War. And we're gonna talk about that book and his view of this event and why it's so, basically why this standard account needs to be challenged. So that's kind of a long intro. So Mike, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm doing well, Tim. It's great to be back on your show. And yes, this is the 80th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and the big lie is still going strong.
Mm-hmm. surprise attack? Unprovoked?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I mean, the Japanese may as well have just called FDR on the phone and said, we're coming, I mean, listen, our intelligence gathering capabilities and radio and radar and whatnot, also the British and the code breakers, you don't move a fleet like that across the Pacific and nobody knowing about it. I mean, they knew the attack was coming, but and even establishment historians today, this fact has begun to seep out a bit. So it's almost like they do a limited hangout, and there's a few of them, and they're allowed to say this. It's interesting. They're allowed to say that it's plausible that FDR had advanced knowledge, but for the good of the world and the greater good, he let it happen, which is kind of disgusting, but at least that's what they say. But it goes much deeper than that. It's not just a advanced knowledge of surprise attack, because if you buy that storyline, you know, that still feeds into the myth of the big bad Japanese were coming to attack for no reason, okay? But it is, so it's deeper than that. It was provoked months and months of relentless provocation of the Japanese put them in a position where they had to. And maybe for some of your listeners, this is a bit much to accept, but, you know, I'm sorry. This is the truth. They had to make a first strike at Pearl Harbor in order to gain an early advantage, because the United States and Japan were already at war. The war did not begin at Pearl Harbor. And it was a covert war, yet it was brutal nonetheless. The United States, or FDR, was totally backing up the Chinese and instigating them under Chiang Kai-shek to continue the war against Japan. All the while, Japan was pleading with the United States to act as an intermediary and negotiate something and put an end to it. But the U.S. kept instigating. There were OSS intelligence operatives active. There was the Flying Tigers were flying missions. And there was actually shooting going on. So the United States was at war. And then when it escalated to the point where they're issuing ultimatums to Japan, you know, we're cutting off your oil, we're shutting down the Panama Canal. But if you go into Indonesia to get your oil, you'll be at war with us, you know. So it's all just all kind of outrageous provocations, one on top of another. So the United States was already at war. And so the attack on Pearl Harbor was really more of a counterattack, if you look at it that way.
Yeah, and, I mean, if you look at Japan's moves in the 40-41 period, Japan was really going after the sort of the beleaguered European colonial powers. And why the American people looked at it and said, why would we have to come to the defense of the European empires in Asia when Japan, they're just exchanging one colonial master for another, right? And this is an Asian one. But it was portrayed as sort of this plan to sort of conquer the world, so, or, you know, part of the Axis scheme to conquer the world. But, yeah.
Well, even the countries that Japan went into during the war, be it the Philippines or Burma, Indonesia, that was after Pearl Harbor. So mm-hmm. And that was to chase the British out. Okay. So even that was provoked. So it was just a war between Japan and China, which the United States engineered and going back to, you know, even years before World War II, they're backing up China. You know, you make war against Japan and we'll get you Manchuria. You know, this is what I do. It was like a proxy war. Mm-hmm. But now there's an even deeper layer to this. It's over in Europe in June of that same year. This is 6 months before Pearl Harbor. Hitler, in response to a massive Soviet buildup along the German frontier, which, you know, the historians don't like to talk about. You know, we're led to believe that Hitler, for one, just no reason whatsoever, he's at war with Britain and he decides to open up a second front. But he had to, because Stalin was preparing to betray the non-aggression pact and take all of Europe.
This is the icebreaker theory, right? Or the book called Icebreaker.
Well, that's right. Well, it's not a theory. I mean, the amount of men and material that the Germans captured within the first few weeks is just staggering. And like, how is that possible? Well, because the Soviets were in an offensive formation. To use a football analogy, everybody was on the line of scrimmage. They were coming. So when you surprise them like that, you catch everything. Okay, in a defensive posture, you have layers of defense, so it's difficult to advance. So Hitler caught them with their pants down, and the Germans made it all the way to the gates of Moscow before the winter set in. And it really looked like the end of the Bolshevik Empire, because once spring of 1942 would come along, you know, the Germans were just poised to pick up right where they left off. So the communists, who absolutely infested the Roosevelt administration and the State Department, they were in a panic. Okay, this is their, you know, this is their boss, Joe Stalin, for many of them. He's going down. But the American people wanted no part of any war in Europe. It was like 3-1 opposed. The thinking was, okay, let Hitler and Stalin fight it out. Big deal. You know, what do we care about the bloody Bolsheviks? Everybody knew what they were about. So there really was no opening for FDR to drag us into a war with Germany. I mean, there were provocations against German shipping and things like that. But Germany ignored it because they certainly did not want to give the United States any pretext to come in. Now, Germany and Japan were bound by a defensive treaty. So they figured, okay, we're already backing up China and we're already got a presence there and the British are there. Let's provoke the Japanese. Let's put them in a position. And this is right from the diary of Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War. He talked about being in the meeting. He says it was discussed, how do we place Japan in the position of making the first move? That's his words. And so you had this relentless provocation. And then when they threatened to cut off their oil and threaten war, Japan made the first move. The American people didn't know any of this intrigue was going on behind the scenes. You understand?
They never know.
They were following, you know, Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams that year. That was
yes, that's right.
Joe DiMaggio hit 56 straight consecutive games, and Ted Williams hit 400 that year.
That's right. So who has time to follow events in Europe when that's going on?
No. And so they wake up. They're like, what? The Japanese attack Pearl Harbor? And then it's like, wow, the Japs and the Germans really are the boogeymen. And it was just this hysteria and this massive and powerful anti-war movement.
Farm boys from Iowa and Idaho end up dying on some rock in the South Pacific.
it's just horrible. And so many young men that very next day, they're at the recruitment offices. Mm-hmm. You know, kids lying about their age, 16-year-old, 17-year-old kids saying they're 18. They're going to go fight all gung-ho to defend the country. And it was horrible. And then FDR, that fiend, you know, he comes out with a black armband and he gives his famous speech, that will live in infamy. It's just horrible. And they bought it. They bought it back then. Just like they buy things, just like they sold the weapons of mass destruction lie, you know, sometime back in the Iraq war. But this was bigger. And that's how we ended up. It was like an overwhelming, almost unanimous vote to go to war against Germany and Japan. And eventually that's what saved the Soviet Empire, because now, you know, the Soviets were worried about Japan on their Pacific coast, but now Japan's got a war with the United States on its hands. They're not going to attack the Soviet Union. So they didn't have to worry about that front opening up. And then all these supplies now, billions and billions of dollars and tanks and trucks and guns and bombs and even things like cans of food and shoes and socks, the industrial might of the United States, which was 50% of the manufacturing capacity of the world at that time, okay, was put at the service of Joe Stalin. So they were getting all these supplies. And now Hitler's got to worry about a second front. The Americans are coming. So everything began to change.
So the arsenal of democracy was sending supplies to Joe Stalin, that big Democrat, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It was the arsenal of Bolshevism and globalism. And ultimately, that's really what the war was about. Hitler liberated Germany from the New World Order. And we had to get him back. It's that simple. And that's why we went to war. And that's why he has been demonized and vilified, you know, ever since. And that is why.
Yeah, there was an opposition to this agenda. Because you had the American First Committee, which had more than, I think, 900,000 dues-paying members. Their offices were raided on December 8th by the FBI, and the membership list was seized. So the FBI, FBI has been politicized for the longest time. But it was Charles Lindbergh who gave that speech on September 11th of all days in 1941 in Des Moines, Iowa, where he said the three most important groups who have been pressing the country toward war are the British, the Jewish, and the Roosevelt administration. Behind these groups, but of lesser importance, are a number of capitalists, Anglophiles, intellectuals who believe that their future and the future of mankind depend upon the domination of the British Empire. Add to these communistic groups who were opposed to the intervention until a few weeks ago. The official Communist Party was for neutrality until the invasion of Russia. And I believe I have named major war agitators of this in this country for that speech, by the way, which is completely accurate. He was demonized and the hero became, the villain, or he became sort of persona non grata by the mainstream media at the time because of that that speech he gave. But it was true.
It was absolutely true. But Pearl Harbor had the effect of, in an instant, completely neutralizing the massive anti-war movement. There was the Million Mom Marches. There were mothers marches across the country. I mean, it was just no way that FDR was going to drag this country. He was going to do it anyway. I mean, they would have started just
like Wilson in 1916. Yeah. He campaigned.
It's despicable. You can find there's films on YouTube. You can find them. I will say it again and again and again. Your boys will not be going to foreign wars. The whole time he's planning, to take us exactly into war.
Yeah, and I think he also implemented for the first time ever a peacetime draft or conscription, which I guess they thought at the time was defensive, but Dr. New Deal became Dr. Win the War. That was the whole.
The draft went into effect in 1940.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, it was a 1-year draft, and when the first batch, the first class of draftees, when their year was up. It was like early autumn in 1941. They were told, no, you got to stay. Okay. So they had them, and then they had the new batch coming in. So it was like they already hit the ground running, and then they really ramped up the draft. And then you also had millions of volunteers. It was just a horrible, horrible con job. But that was the Great War for the New World Order. And I refer to World War II as the foundational mythology that defines the modern world. And it's essential to understand the fraud and what it was all about if you're going to understand the present time. I really believe that, because everything came out of that war. It really brought in the New World Order, or the skeletal structure of it, after the war. Think about it. The UN came into effect as a result. NATO, the CIA, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the partition of Palestine, and then the state of Israel. A few years later, the Bilderberg Group meetings. Then there was the early, they were called the Benelux trade bloc, Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, which then expanded into the common market. And today it's the EU. So everything come out of that war, the Bretton Woods Conference, and the dollar being the reserve currency, all its agencies, and the World Health Organization, and the UNICEF, and the UNESCO, that teaches all the communism and the perversion to the kids today, and on it goes. Everything you see wrong today that we're fighting against, it came out of World War II. It was already on the drawing board. They needed this history-altering event. And people have got to understand that. And that's what it's about. And Hitler had rescued Germany from this evil. And I go into this in The Bad War. And from the time I published it, 2015, up until they banned it in 2018 from Amazon, I had 350 4- and 5-star reviews. It was selling like crazy. So that means, Amazon was making good money on it too. But But at this time, the usual suspects were pressuring Amazon to remove any book, certain books that give a different explanation of World War II and what I call the Hola hoax. And Amazon resisted and resisted. Bezos kept ignoring their letters. And then finally in 2018, there was a rash of so-called anti-Semitic attacks and graffitis on cemeteries and synagogues. And you know what that's all about, right? Mm-hmm. And then there was a nasty one right in Seattle, in the shadow of the headquarters of Amazon. And then the pressure got to be too much. And Amazon said, we've got to take some of these hate books off. And they holocausted like 30 books, World War II and mainly the Hola hoax. And I suppose it's a badge of honor. Mine was among that class that was removed. But the good news is your listeners can still get the Bad War at my website, realhistorychan.com. There's a little tab up top. You'll see the Bad War. You can read a free excerpt. It's full of illustrations. It's an 8.5 by 11 book. It's like 320 pages. And I got to say, it's unique in a sense that I don't think there's any other book like that that gives it to you in such an engaging and understandable manner. And that's what my work specializes in. I don't write these 1,000-page tomes, you know, for the scholarly class. It's just for the everyday person. You could read it. It's clear, concise, to the point, tons of images and captions. And I go even deeper than World War II. I go into World War I and even the alliances that were coming into place in the 1890s. They were already being put into place to engulf Europe in the future world wars, because that's how they reorganized Europe and it destroyed it. So it goes back that deep. And when you see what these globalists, one worlders were plotting as far back as the 1800s, it gives you so much of a better understanding by the time you get to World War II. And in my book, it's almost like the first half of the book, it's history. And in the middle of the book, it picks up in World War II. But you've got to have that critical context. So for that, my book is very unique. And, you know, it's a shame that they banned it, because a lot of newbies were stumbling across it through the Amazon search engine. Put in World War II and it was showing up on first page. And it's the only book that, I mean, you see it and it kind of shocks you. The Bad War? Who's this guy calling World War II the Bad War? I never heard of that opinion before, you know? Because there's nonsense about the good war. You know, that's the inside joke. It was a good war for them. You know what I'm saying? For them. Mm-hmm. The one worlders, the globalists, the criminals, the Jewish bankers and supremacists. For that crowd, it was a good war. But for the rest of humanity, it was just such a horrific bloodbath. And it's so misunderstood. But Germany and Japan are totally innocent.
Yeah, there's an attitude. You come across this in sort of the academic historical accounts, the official accounts of these wars, particularly the First World War. We hear things like the alliance system, war by timetables, this series of missteps and inexplicable mistakes, you know, in the summer of 1914, when the war could have been so easily avoided, yet nevertheless went to war over this incident in Sarajevo when Archduke Ferdinand's assassinated by this Gavial Princip, who's linked to this group called the Black Hand, which I think has ties to Freemasonry and British intelligence. But in the book, you talk about the changing alliance systems, how they successfully got Germany to cancel its alliance with Russia, or treaty with alliance with Russia, and organized an alliance with France and Russia. Then at the same time, you have, again, behind the scenes, the British public doesn't know this, that the Britain is abandoning its policy of splendid isolation and establishing this entente cordiale or cordial agreement with France, in agreement to go to war, you know, should Germany go to war with France. But nevertheless, the war starts, and the war is going pretty well for Germany up until 1916, sustaining a loss, but Germany is winning. And then you have this thing called the Balfour Declaration, which really, I'll let you, what's the significance of the Balfour Declaration? beyond what most people know. You know, obviously Britain's promised right. to give Palestine to the Jews, even though they don't control it. But I'll let you explain.
At that time, Germany was in a very strong position. They were winning the war.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. France was ready to bow out. And if France bowed out, you know, England would have to make a peace. Germany had an offer on the table all along, even before the shooting started. They wanted, let's not do this. And then even as the war is going on and Germany's winning, Germany's offer is, listen, let's just call the war off. Everybody go home. And that's it. No, you know, no land transfer, no reparation, nothing like that. So that was, and that was Germany's offer. Now, the Zionists and the Jewish supremacists and the globalists who, you know, engineered this war, well, they didn't want that. They wanted the war to continue. So they saw their opportunity, an opportunity that they had created. And the Zionist leaders, and this is all documented, this is all fact, this isn't conspiracy theory, so-called, they went to the British government and they said, listen, you could still win the war if the United States comes in on your side. And they totally controlled and owned Woodrow Wilson. Okay, that whole greasy bunch of characters, Jacob Schiff and Paul Warburg and Bernard Baruch, Felix Frankfurter, all those guys. They controlled Wilson, and they had dirt on him. Wilson had an old girlfriend back in the day, which is a big no-no. It was a different era back then. You know, so they blackmailed him. They controlled him. They owned him. And the British went for the offer, and they made this agreement. Okay, because Turkey is in the war too, and they're on Germany's side. So they said, okay, after the war, we will bust up the Ottoman Empire, and we will establish a territory. We will take Palestine, and we'll begin the process of giving a Jewish homeland in Palestine. They had no business giving Palestine away. You know, I mean, there were Arabs there, 95% Arabs, but that was the deal they made. And then, so then they went to work, and then Wilson, who had also promised, you know, no war, that was his campaign slogan in 1916. He kept us out of war. I've got it in my book. I got images of the old campaign buttons. And as soon as he got in, he got reinaugurated, boom, everything changed.
Yeah, I think within a month, right?
it changed real quick. They had to pay off
a month later.
And that began to now when the United States arrived, it did turn the tide of the war. However, still there was not one inch of German territory that was occupied, and there was this, for the Americans to make it all the way to Berlin would have been a meat grinder. So there was. In other words, there was no need for Germany to surrender like they did because it was not a negotiated surrender. They basically, and it's so insane when you think about it. Wilson said he promised them, quote, I'm offering a peace without victory. Okay. So he said to the Germans, look, just lay down your arms and go home and we'll make a nice deal.
Yeah, they sued for peace under the terms of the 14 points, right?
Yeah. Germany was begging for peace. But they actually laid down their weapons and went home based on an empty promise. And, you know, maybe some of the people who were in favor of this were deluded, but there was a heavy communist influence and Zionist influence at work in Germany conducting this treason. And that's what it was. So they laid down their weapons. They went home, and then the next thing they know, they are under occupation, and then they're forced to sign the Treaty of Versailles. They had no say so whatsoever in the terms of the peace treaty, and they were under a hunger blockade that killed many thousands of people. And the blockade would not be lifted until they signed the Versailles Treaty, and it was just a horror show. Massive reparations that destroyed the economy. They took territory. There was ethnic cleansing of Germans that had to leave an area of Prussia, Poland. So it was just the most horrific, brutal punishment. And Germany was the one country that did not want World War I. They were not responsible, yet they were forced to take all the blame. And this is important to understand because Now you begin to understand the growing resentment of the German people in the 20s towards the Treaty of Versailles.
This is the war guilt also, clause. Yeah.
Also towards the architects of the Treaty of Versailles, which is the International Jewish Mafia.
Yeah, so you're saying is the stab in the back myth is not really a myth. There's actually truth to it.
There's absolutely truth to it. And in fact, after they made the Balfour deal, the British started dropping leaflets because they had the old-fashioned biplanes back then. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't have heavy bombers, but they started dropping leaflets in Yiddish over areas of Germany where there were Jews. And it was telling them, hey, after the war, you're going to get a nice homeland in Palestine. So that just tells you what the British thought of the Jewish loyalty to Germany. So there's no question about it. And then the Communist Party, which on the day of the surrender, 11-11 at 11 a.m., which is a satanic significance, by the way, the Communists took over Berlin. And the Kaiser had to flee for his life. He fled to Holland. And so they were attempting to do what the Bolsheviks did in St. Petersburg. First, they took over the cities. Then they took over the rest of Russia. And this is what they're trying to do in Germany. But it failed. It was put down. But the leaders, these communist leaders, were all Jews. Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. Mm-hmm. The major fake news at that time was all Jewish owned. And so now you have a situation where Germany, for decades prior, there was no problem at all in Germany with so-called anti-Semitism, okay? It only existed on the political margins. The Jews were very happy in Germany. No problem at all. But then all of a sudden, anti-Semitism, quote-unquote, broke out in the early 20s. And, you know, a rational person's got to ask themselves, well, wait a minute. Everything was fine. Jews weren't complaining about Germany for 40, 50 years, no problem. But now you got Mein Kampf is becoming a best. Well, what happened here? Well, what happened? It was the stab in the back. The international Jewish bankers, the Jewish heads of the German Communist Party. Then you had the proliferation of the pornography and the degeneracy. And it was all by this tiny Jewish minority, and this is becoming clear in the 20s. So again, this is critical context building up to the 30s when Hitler came to power, and then internationally the Jewish International wanted to take him out, and there was a long buildup to war. But again, it was a war Germany did not want and did not start. It was Poland that started the war, with Britain and France pushing Poland along to pick the fight. And also FDR behind the scenes was involved in that. So that's
there's that Polish diplomat who writes about that, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's real history right there. When people put their private thoughts in the diary, okay? You know, what people say publicly, when you're analyzing history as a historian, you're trying to put things together, it's a little tricky because people say things publicly and, you know, I got to take that with a grain of salt, but the stuff that people write in their diaries or private letters to one another. But yeah, the Polish ambassador, he writes that, the propaganda apparatus in the United States is completely in the hands of the Jews and FDR wants war, et cetera, et cetera.
Who are these Jewish media moguls at the time?
Well, it was huge. I mean,
there's Hollywood, of course.
In the United States, you know, this is pre-television days, so radio and newspaper were king, okay? There wasn't much to choose from. The dominant newspapers were the New York Times and the Washington Post. And they were not only dominant because, you know, important people read those papers, political people, financial people, but papers all over the country would pick up their stories from the wire, and so the poison would spread all over America. Understand? And then radio, it was CBS radio and NBC radio. So that's four major entities, which, and you could throw Reuters in there too, that's international. So let's say that's five. Well, five out of five were headed by Jewish moguls. Okay. New York Times, the Sulzberger family, which still owns it today. Washington Post, Eugene Meyer, who later passed it down to his daughter, Catherine Meyer, or Catherine Graham. Mm-hmm. So that was in the Meyer-Graham family for 50 years, Jewish. Sarnoff, that was NBC Radio. He headed that up for 50 years. And then Bill Paley, his real name was Bill Paloff, another Russian Jew, just like Sarnoff. He headed CBS for 50 years. So this from the 20s to the 70s, these individuals. There you have it right there. That's the quote unquote American media. And in their hands, it was completely in Jewish hands. And they were misrepresenting everything throughout the 1930s build up to the war. And then when the war started, I mean, you know, without them, it's not possible. You know, you need the fake news to control the population.
And of course, I think a lot of people are familiar with 1933, the headline, Judea declares war on Germany. This is just after Hitler comes to power. So there's an international economic boycott plan to isolate Germany. Again, now, if you point out Jewish power behind the scenes, you're called anti-Semitic conspiracy right. theorists. But nevertheless, they're able to organize an international boycott of a major European power. So obviously there's some organization there, I might say. How would you distinguish, the Jewish, I guess, interest or power block versus the English? Or at this point, is it one of the same because of the Rothschilds had successfully taken over the British Empire at this point?
It's interesting. The two establishments, and this is the same in the United States as it was in Britain. The Anglo establishments kind of merged with the Jewish establishment, you know, because they had money. They had more money than the Anglos. Okay, so they made for interesting bedfellows. Mm-hmm. Okay. But in the long run, the Jews were much more cunning because they took the press from them. So it's quite interesting. They run everything, but it's always rich white guys. You might associate with Thurston Howell from Gilligan's Island or something.
Yeah, the Wasp.
That's who people think run Wall Street or the media become. So it's quite a trick, but. You know, initially they got in bed with each other as equals, but and this was the same with the royals, the royal family of Britain, you know. Uh-huh. But in time, and there was a lot of intermarriage too. So I mean, the top dogs internationally are the Jewish mafia and the Rothschilds, you know.
Yeah, this relationship, consanguinity, if you will, dates back. From what I understand is the 19th century. When the English elite, the aristocracy or the landed air, they wanted to build these large manor homes, which required cash, so they borrowed money from these Jewish families, and so they went increasing the debt to maintain their status and standard of living, and a family that typifies this relationship is the Churchill family, correct?
Oh yeah, the Churchill's ties to big money jewelry go way back. I talk about this in one of my other books, Planet Rothschild, a 2-volume set. Going back to the British wars against Napoleon, the final coalition wars, it was a total of 7 wars that the British organized against Napoleon to put down France. Because, you know, the British elite always felt that, you know, it's kind of their destiny to be the big dogs in Europe. So anytime a country rose up on a continent, they had to put it down. But they went for financing. They went to the House of Rothschild. And without Rothschild funding, the 5th, 6th, and 7th wars against Napoleon simply do not happen. Okay? They would have just left them alone. And Napoleon didn't want war either. Now, Nathan Rothschild got a concession out of the British and also the Austrians and the Prussians, the allies of that day. They came crawling to him on their hands and knees for money. But he said, you know, after this war against Napoleon's over, there's got to be a better position for the Jews in Europe. And they're like, yeah, we'll do it. And after the war, indeed, in the early 1820-21, there was the Congress of Vienna. And, you know, that was one of the deals that was made. So all of these new opportunities were opened up to Jews who prior to that time were not considered full citizens. They were almost like resident aliens.
This is the era of Jewish emancipation throughout Europe, right?
That's right. And right away, they start going for the press. They start buying up newspapers, agencies that are still around today. Reuters, which was there's another big one in France, a big one in Germany. This is all 1830s, 1840s. They start going for the press. And that was critical. That is really how they began to undermine the aristocracy that had gotten into bed with them, okay? And ultimately, all of the anti-monarchy movements were led by this force, you know, this coalition of the Jewish press, and then you had the communist parties. It's all part of the same octopus system. And eventually, all the monarchies were torn down, and the people of Europe got their so-called freedom in the form of democracy. But the object of the scam is you control the parliamentary democracies, you fund the parties, and you control the parties with your corrupt politicians. So, you know, it wasn't about liberating the people of Europe from the tyrannical kings. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's how they emerged as the masters of Europe.
Yeah, what's that quote? It may be apocryphal, but it's Nathan Rothschild saying, "I care not who writes the laws if I can control the money." It doesn't matter who's writing the laws because I can buy all the politicians. You know?
Well, that's right. Yeah. And I guess you could also apply that sentiment to the press. Now, you take Nathan Rothschild. Well, there were five brothers, the five sons of the original Meyer Rothschild. There was one in each capital of Europe. And then they had children, and it's just generational. Like the big shot Rothschilds of today, Jacob de Rothschild, Evelyn de Rothschild, Nat de Rothschild, mm-hmm. they are the sons of the son of the son of the son of the son, starting with Nathan. But there's many other branches. So that's what gives this thing its continuity.
And also you got the Rothschild. With that, you also get the transnational nature of this network, meaning you have the Warburgs in the United States and the Warburgs in Germany. You have the Rothschilds in England, the Rothschilds in Italy and in Germany. And nominally they're German, they're American, they're British, but really they're networking behind the scenes to control the dialectic, and they can start these wars and that sort of thing. Yeah.
And then you look at the Sulzberger family now, they've owned the New York Times, which is the flagship of the American fake news for 125 years, the same family. Mm-hmm. It went from Adolf Oakes to his son-in-law, who was a Sulzberger, who married his daughter and Oakes, and then it went to his son, and then to his son, and to his son. And a couple of years ago, the publisher stepped down and gave it to his son. He's Sulzberger. So that's a long time. So you see the continuity of this thing, just moving forward little by little by little. The globalism, the one world order, and you know, there's really only been one man in history whoever beat these guys, at least for a while, and that was Hitler. And when Austria was incorporated into the Reich, he put Rothschild in jail, and they took his bank. Okay, so that's what you have to understand. I mean, so everything, and you know, we see the same force today, locked in mortal combat with Donald Trump, and it's unmistakable. I mean, it is the same self-perpetuating force. And stuff gets really deep, Terry. I mean, you know, these elites, they're into Satanism and the raping of children. And, you know, the Epstein Island, that's all about them. Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell. They're Mossad agents, by the way. So it's just an incredible story. And it really dates back. I mean, the first major move was the French Revolution, which occurred like 10 years after the founding of the Illuminati, you know? Mm-hmm. And just tying back to World War II, that's what it's all about. That's what it was all about. So was World War I. But World War II, I mean, you could call it just one world war, right? World War Part One and World War Part Two is essentially the same sides too. And for them, for these people, these monsters, it certainly was a good war.
Well, yeah, it's been referred to as sort of a second 30 years war, which I think is appropriate because you saw the destruction of German power and independence, which was critical to the globalist, the sort of the Judeo-Masonic, you know, empire, which was represented by, or at least controlled Great Britain and eventually the United States. These are the sea powers, you know, versus the land powers. And Britain even developed what's called this Halford Mackinder, the Mackinder Doctrine, where where Eurasia is the pivot of world power and you have to control that. And that's what both of these world wars were a part of. I mean, you had Germany after unification in 1870, come on like gangbusters. It was unified under Bismarck. And the trade union that they created, and this sort of alternative economic model, as opposed to the so-called free trade British model, and with Germany becoming so economically powerful, there was a threat to German power. To British power, and that's why you had this sort of this scheme to go to war to smash German independence and power, and this 30-year conflict you see, and you see it today now with the Belt and Road and the sort of the scheming of the the Atlanticist powers versus the Eurasian landmass powers represented Russia and China. Obviously these powers are imperfect and they have their own problems, but you see this sort of geopolitical contour throughout the centuries being played out even today. I mean, the same sort of Mackinder Doctrine being implemented, because you can't control the economic systems in order to impose the dollar and control the currency, international trade, you want, the sea power to be dominant. You don't want an internal, sort of a condominium between Europe, Russia, and China. If that, then the Atlantis powers are on the outs. And that's you could say that's the Judeo-Masonic powers, this, or at least their successors,
Yeah, that's right. And the Judeo power was quite skilled at stroking the egos of the Anglo power. Bernard Baruch in his own book talks about how he would meet with the British leaders and say, eliminating Germany from the global market will maximize your profit. So it's all presented to them like, an appeal to British ultra-nationalism, British ultra-capitalism, you see? But they were playing them because in the end, Britain lost its empire too. And what's Britain today? It's nothing but a province, of the European Union. Well, they got out of the European Union, but still it's a shadow of what Britain once was. It was a fatal embrace when the ruling Anglo classes, as corrupt as they were, when they got in bed with the Jewish supremacists, match for them.
Yeah, and that goes back maybe as far back as Cromwell.
Cromwell, he was their boy.
And so planning long, because they got back to England under that deal. After 400 years of being expelled. People, it's hard for people to, again, it goes back to my original statement, is most people just sort of accept the given narrative, the received narrative, the official narrative of the Second World War, and that is Allies good, Axis powers bad. Obviously, the Nazis are the archetypical, evil figure.
What really burns me up, then, is so many people on our side today repeat the enemy propaganda and they call the Democrats like Nazis. It just kills me. It's just total nonsense. The German people were the happiest people on the face of the earth. This is confirmed by outside observers. They went to Germany. They said the recovery is miraculous. Okay. Not just the economic recovery that Hitler ushered in and engineered, the culture, the morals. I mean, you had a country that was completely degraded and they came back in such a short amount of time. It was really, miraculous. And the German people were happy and they were free. And they had control of their currency. Okay. They had the soundest currency in the world. They didn't have an interest debt money currency system where the people are buried in debt. Okay. Hitler was very pro-business. He cut taxes. Yet at the same time, he respected the working man. And so there was this kind of understanding between the business class and the labor class. The German system was, hey, go ahead, make all the money you want, make your profits, do business. That's great. You got to treat your employees right. So they got rid of all the communist labor unions. Because that's what they were. They were run by commies. And they set up a national labor front instead, which kind of did the negotiation. If you look at some of the factories that were built during this period in Germany, they had wide open spaces, giant bay windows, and they were clean. It's like they had gyms in there. You would want to go to work. It wasn't a sweatshop. You understand? Mm-hmm. They called themselves the National Socialist Party, but it's not to be confused with the socialism of Karl Marx or the Democrats that, pay people to not work and make babies out of wedlock and support them and get their votes. It wasn't that. It was things like programs they had for the working man. He wanted to save some money. The employer would match it, and then the state would match it. They get to take a nice vacation. You had factories workers taking these luxury cruises. And they were just amazing. The resorts that they built, it was like a
all for one
type of thing. Yeah,
strength through joy.
That's right.
That ship was tragically sunk during the war. The Wilhelm Gustav was one of those ships that were, I think, created for that. Of course, there was a tragedy that occurred late part of the war. 12,000 people or about, what was it, went down on that ship? 12,000 refugees, women and children, old people, sunk by a Soviet sub.
I call it the Titanic times 12 nobody's ever heard of.
It's interesting because, again, people look at the, obviously the war is a good war because it destroyed Nazi tyranny and the forces of genocide and all the things that we were taught about the war. They look at the Nazi party as sort of seizing power. They through violence and intimidation, they were undemocratic. Although Hitler never said he was a parliamentarian. In fact, he was very critical of liberal democracy because he correctly said the liberal democracy is a cover for oligarchy. I don't think he's wrong about that. But in the West, we have a sort of an ideological conviction to democracy, right? I mean, so any party or system that's outside that design, we're trained to think of as tyrannical, despite the fact that we're not, and so that's part of the reason I think why people look at it, as sort of Germany's descent into darkness. Again, it's so hard to break out of that training because so many people, again, all the movies, the documentaries, all this stuff, they're just marinated in that. How do you break that? They'll look at things like, how would you dress? Like if I were to say Hitler came to power, 1934, Night of the Long Knives. How would you justify it? An act of political gangsterism like that?
Sure. And you know what? Every one of these events that was made, that was spun to make Hitler look bad, I addressed them in my book. And one by one, it's just lie, 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 and lie. Okay. Night of the Long Knives. And in my book, I love to reproduce old headlines from like the New York Times, for example, because that's like an enemy paper. So when they give you something that's a bit of truth that kind of contradicts the official narrative, you could take it to the bank because it's like testimony against interest. But the Night of the Long Knives was a coup attempt by a group of thugs who ran the SA stormtroopers led by the homosexual Ernst Röhm. And they were more than likely they were British intelligence agents. Okay. But Hitler had come to power, so he's still weak. So this is an element within his own party that wants to stage a violent coup, which would have triggered a civil war. So it was an act of treason. It was a coup that was put down. It was to be an armed military overthrow of a democratically elected government. Okay? So that's the context of it. It wasn't Hitler going after his enemies. They were traitors in every sense of the word. They would have triggered a civil war in Germany if they overthrew Hitler. So they were rounded up and they were imprisoned or executed. Okay, like any other country would do if the plotters of a violent overthrow were exposed. And the headlines even say Hitler puts down coup attempt. American newspapers. But now they call it Night of the Long Knives, which was coined by British propagandists. It's not what the Germans called it. They called it Operation, I think it was Hummingbird. It was an operation.
And, it's not quite as intimidating.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so on the one hand, you have the propagandists say, oh, the SA stormtroopers, the brown shirts, they were horrible, bad. Well, it was the leaders of that organization, paramilitary organization, that Hitler put down. So which one is it? Are they good guys or bad guys? You know? So that's all that was. And more than likely, I mean, there's a lot of evidence that points to these guys being in the employ of British intelligence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Hitler cleaned them out.
Well, except what is a government willing to do to maintain its power? Of course, I don't think the U.S. government is in a position to lecture anybody on, you know, on ethics and morality and warfare when it comes to maintaining its power. I mean, look at what Lincoln did to maintain the Union. Under what he thought was appropriate, you know, so resorting to force and breaking all types of laws and suspending habeas corpus and these things. People have that. You know, how about like all the street fighting? Now, it's interesting because it's one of the things where they take it out of context. Whereas they don't realize people don't realize at the time you had communists. You know, you had obviously what occurred in Russia, and that was. People were aware, you know, what occurred to the Romanov family and what the Cheka was doing in Russia, and who were the Cheka, what ethnicity they belonged to. But you had all, you know, the communist street thugs who were engaged in all types of violence. But usually, when we read the history, we only hear about, you know, SA, brown shirts, stormtroopers, right. Carrying out violence. Well, you know, there's a brewing civil war here. You know, there's two sides of these things, or maybe three sides. And so you have to put that in context, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the so-called big bad brown shirts, they were just the muscle that was needed to counter the communist real thugs who would have, you know, they would have committed genocide if they got into power. So they were like the Antifa of that time, mm-hmm. Only much, much more violent and powerful. So that's, you know, again, you have to put things in their proper context that they owe it to the brown shirts that communist insurrection was put down. Mm-hmm. You understand? So it wasn't like they're going around, hey, you said something bad about Hitler, we're going to beat you up. You know what I mean? It was to put down the communists. Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people think they know. That the the Reichstag fire was a false flag, was staged by Hitler to create excuse to create the, you know, the Enabling Act and establish his dictatorship, because they've been told this. But you have a different view of this incident.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's absolutely no evidence of that at all. Okay, and even in the Western newspapers, nobody even mentioned it at the time. Mm-hmm. They caught it. I mean, again, you have to look at the context. The country, this is Hitler. He's very early in his regime now. Okay, so he's dealing with an attempted coup from the Long Knives. You've got the communists. Germany is still unstable. Hitler is still weak. Why should anybody be surprised that the communists would take advantage of an unstable government to try to overthrow it? This is what they do. You see, mm-hmm. So. When Hitler said at the time, and when they announced that the communists were preparing an overthrow of this brand new, very weak government, they had to put it down. And that was the, to be the start of it, was the burning of the Reichstag. So why is it so hard for people to believe that the communists would do such a thing? This is par for the course. That's what they do. So it wasn't a false flag. And again, I did an article on this. It's somewhere at realhistorychan.com. In the buildup before that, all of the communist street actions and the threats and their propaganda posters, they were pretty much openly threatening a violent overthrow. You know, there's posters calling, "This system must end." And there's a guy with his fist in the air, and at his feet is Hitler and Hindenburg. They were plotting to overthrow the government. And that's what the Reichstag fire was all about. They caught a Dutch communist on the grounds of the building, and it led to the Enabling Act, but not because it was a false flag. Let me do a false flag so I can gain power. No, it led to the Enabling Act because that's how close the communists were to destabilizing and overthrowing Germany. Because when you get to that state, when the Bolsheviks are about to take over a country, there's always a last-minute reaction. And it's either going to go one way or the other. So, again, that has to be understood in the context of the chaos of the times and just how weak Hitler was when he first came in there. So, you know, so if you were going to take him out, whether it's British intelligence through the so-called, you know, long knives, or whether it's the Marxists being directed from Moscow, if you're going to take him out, you better do it early before he can begin to solidify power. And they failed in doing so. And yes, he did grab more power for himself, not as any kind of premeditated plot. And I'll tell you something else. I almost feel like I know this man intimately, talking about Hitler. So much. I've read about it, learned about him, the character that he has. I almost see the similarity in personality traits to myself. What I mean by that is that he's a creative person, a soft soul, an empathetic person, but he gets pissed off at evil. You know what I mean? What I'm saying is he would be incapable of doing this kind of sneaky stuff. There was no lying in the man, ever, ever. The guy was a straight shooter. He was just different from the political scum that we're used to observing in our so-called democratic systems.
Well, I mean, he did condemn democracy and parliamentarianism. He saw it as just...
Well, because he knew what it was. Democracy is just a front for these globalists.
Whereas the current Democratic politicians care not for democracy.
That's right. But you know what? The National Socialist Party, so-called Nazi Party, they never called themselves that. That was a derogatory term. Mm-hmm. Was the most democratic political entity in the world at that time. Just because it's one party doesn't mean it's democratic. And what I mean by that is membership was open to anybody and everybody of good character. Okay? You could join the party and you can get involved and you can vote with the party. But it represented a unified people and a unified ideal. So just because you have one party, a so-called dictatorship, no. And there was also... A degree of political decentralization in Germany. You had the governors, I think they called them Gauleiters. Mm-hmm. So you could, you know, anybody could join the party and speak your mind, say we should do this or that, this or the other thing, you know. They weren't going to let you in if you're a communist or a degenerate, of course. But the membership was open to anybody of good character. As long as you didn't have some serious blemish or criminal record, you could get involved politically and join the party. So it was democratic internally. But everybody was happy. And he literally was a 99% approval. Okay? Because of what he did for Germany within 3-4 years. So...
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about concentration camps and Dachau and these things. And I was reading and I found that the population of the concentration camps prior to the outbreak of war never surpassed, 12,000. So there was no, brown terror, if you will, like there was a red terror. In Germany, there was no broad terror to maintain the regime's power like you saw in the communist countries. So from that, you can infer some sort of broad popular support. Obviously, once the war broke out, it changed. for obvious, the same reason that other countries would inter people and these things. And then it gets into the whole issue of the, you know, of the so-called Holocaust and that, you know. You have issue like, you know, some like, you know, the Kristallnacht, Night of Broken Glass, this assault on Jewish properties and businesses. This is another thing that most people listen to, November 9th, 1938, if I recall. Something like that. How would you respond to something to that?
Well, again, context. What triggered this response? How few people know? Well, I'm going to tell you that what happened earlier that day is a Polish Jew walked into the German embassy in Paris, and he just walked up to a young German officer there, diplomat, and he just shot him and murdered him. And this wasn't the first time this happened. So this triggered a reaction, which was nowhere near what is being portrayed today. There was some vandalism. There was some arson. There were some broken windows.
Are you saying the Jewish press exaggerated it?
Yeah. How about that? Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, and this is confirmed. Again,
6 million, really 6 million businesses were destroyed in Germany that night.
Yeah, 6 million. There you go. But it's interesting because it reveals that there were prosperous businesses still in Berlin at that time.
Yeah.
Owned by Jews. But it's been confirmed. This is confirmed by diary entries, how angry Hitler was when he learned about the riots. And he called in Goebbels, the minister of so-called propaganda. He said, "What the hell's going on? Are you inciting this?" Said, no. And there's something mysterious about the systematic manner that these riots occurred. They had the smell of a false flag and also a bit of Jewish lightning, you know, some arson attacks and insurance claims. And it's true.
That's you can never discount that. That's true. The insurance fraud.
But it was embarrassing to Germany, and Hitler was very upset about it because he was very concerned about all the foreign propaganda about, you know, what's going on in Germany. And this happens. And we know from history that, you know, he was ripping people a new butthole. He wanted to know what the hell's going on. What the hell's happened? How did this happen? And nobody had any answers for him. And, you know, I don't have ironclad proof of this, but I think this was probably British intelligence working with the Jews to organize this and you know, make it look bad. And even still, it was exaggerated. But that's Kristallnacht.
Yeah, the Kristallnacht. Which is, you know, people who are just vaguely familiar with history know that term, that German word for Night of the Broken Glass and like Night of the Long Knives.
You get this, the propaganda smell. There's always a slogan.
But if you look back at, you know, just, we know from recent history, you know, from the Cold War and the CIA and its swarming techniques and its false, it's kind of bought and paid for crowds and purple, you know, colored revolutions, you could see this maybe a prototype to destabilize a country by stirring something up, by bringing in a crowd and stirring things up and just for the propaganda purposes. We see in Iran, you know, in just recent years, or way back in the 1950s when they overthrew Mossadegh. So that's a kind of an old game. And again, we can't take these things at face value. You can't take the narratives that we're given at face value because of who controls them in their interests. The media has interests, you know, that aren't in line with the people. And they might be very narrow, specific ethnic interest in this regard, and particularly in the West, because there's no restriction on who can control the media, and it's always going to be rich people who control the media and certain rich people. Now, of course, we have the outbreak of war. We mentioned, you know, Polish intransigence, the Danzig corridor. This becomes a pretext for war, and most people think that, of course, you have in 1938 and 39, you have Germany, Hitler moving first in 35 to rearm the Rhineland, right? Then he moves to which no one does anything about. Then 1938, you have the unification with Austria. Then he moves into Czechoslovakia. Munich, the lessons of Munich and appeasement and these things. These are all things that we were given about this war. And we're being set up to believe that this is Hitler one by one establishing himself so they can expand and conquer Europe. And you're saying this isn't exactly true, because what happened was he didn't really anticipate, nor did he want England and France to declare war on him in September 1939. And when they did, of course, then that created, you know, the war in the West. And he, this, these are things that were beyond Hitler's control. And so it really wasn't, when Hitler invaded the West and took over France, it wasn't German aggression, because France had declared, England had declared war on Germany over Poland, which they could do nothing about, right. You know? So,
and I have this in the book. You can see the headlines. Okay. France, the French invaded Germany before, months before the Germans arrived in Paris. Did you know that?
Yeah, there was an, yeah, then they withdrew, right? Then they went back and
They invaded and they went like 10 miles or so. And then when Germany wrapped up the war in Poland, then they, you know, chased them out of the West.
Yeah.
But France had invaded Germany. Britain had bombed a schoolyard in Germany and killed a bunch of little kids.
Mm-hmm.
And this is before the Germans laid one foot in the West. So they didn't even move westward, even though Britain and France declared war under the pretext of protecting Poland. Hitler didn't make any moves in the West. What he did instead is he pleaded directly and through third parties, you know, for them to rescind their war declarations. He says, why should this war, you know, be fought? There's no reason for this, this and that. But they just kept on accumulating forces, men and material in the Western frontier. There were like 300 British forces. France at the time had the second largest standing military in the world. Okay. Number three was Poland, by the way. All right. So they were building up.
Mm-hmm.
So Poland wasn't some little, you know, backwards country with no military and men on cavalry charging tanks. That's nonsense. They had a very formidable military because they were building up for war, being egged on by the West. So you've got like at least a million men, even more, British and French, and tanks and trucks and everything. And they're building, they're accumulating on the border with Belgium and Holland, because there was not going to be an attack directly from France deep into Germany, because Germany was too heavily fortified there. I mean, the French had their famous Maginot Line. The Germans had a Siegfried Line, which was just as impenetrable. So the only way logistically to really take the war into the German industrial territory was through Belgium and Holland, which are tiny countries. Okay, they're like the size of New Jersey. So when that was the plan, once they launched the war, they were going to secure free passage through so-called neutral Belgium and Holland. And I'm telling you right now, this is a fact. Belgium and Holland were not neutral. They proclaimed their neutrality, but all along, you know, they're part of the League of Nations. They're globalists. You know, that's where the EU is located today. So they were in cahoots. They were going to allow free, safe passage of the French and British military force, which was massive. And they were going to come into the German Rhineland, which is where all their industry is. And Germany knew this was coming, and they beat them to the punch. And that's why the Germans went into Holland and Belgium reluctantly. Prior to that, it was the same scenario with Norway and Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, people have this misconception. They're like, well, if Hitler wanted peace, why is he going in all these countries? Norway, Denmark, Belgium, Luxembourg, Holland, France, Greece, Yugoslavia, on and on and on. But it's always, every single time, a preemptive move to stop the British from encircling, and then later on the Soviets. Because look at Germany on a map. Where are they located? Right in the center of Europe. So they've got three fronts to worry about. So three fronts from which the British could bring the war to them, like they did in World War I. So again, this is all missing context. And once you see it, and you see how desperately, passionately, and sincerely Hitler pleaded for an end to a war, in 39 and 40 and 42, yet they kept encircling and they kept having to make the moves. And then you come to the American fake news and you look at the headlines, everyone, Hitler invades Belgium, Germany invades Holland, Germany invades Norway, Germany invades Greece. So they're brainwashing the public. They make them look like a madman, but they had to go into these countries because once these countries get occupied by the British and the French, now the war is coming. It will be on German territory, which they could not allow. And in the Pacific, it was kind of the same way with Japan when they went into the countries that the British had were the occupying power. They had to chase the British out. And then you look at the headlines in the fake news, the United States, Japan invades Burma, Japan does this, you know. Oh my God. I mean, the fake news is every bit as bad then as it is today. And one of my favorite quotes of Mike King original, I like to say that fake history is the fake news that has passed into the rearview mirror. But it's an amazing story. Go to realhistorychan.com, read the free excerpt for The Bad War up top. Also sign up for my free report, How to Respond to an Anti-Conspiracy Theorist, and get you on the mailing list. But please, people, you need to read this book or the PDF, because I'm telling you, once you understand World War II, and I'm sure the type of individual that listens to your show, Tim, is already way up the learning curve versus the rest of America, okay? But this will really take you to that final step of mastery once you understand World War II.
Yeah, so I've had you on for well over an hour now, and I don't want to tax you too much tonight. I know it's a big topic, and you got to read, so we can't cover it.
Yeah.
But one thing is Adolf Hitler. I know the defense that you make for him tonight is unsettling for a lot of people in their view of Hitler and history, and also their country's role in history, because so much of what we Americans think as being the greatest country ever to exist is we saved civilization by defeating Germany and then defeating the Soviet Union, the Cold War. And so, you know, so a lot of people don't like the fact that you're taking away their villains as much as they don't like people dethroning their heroes. When you take away one of the villains, they actually react more emotionally over these things.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a negative religion in a way, because they got to have their villains to make themselves feel good. And so this reevaluation, the sort of revisionist view of these things is very upsetting for a lot of people. But all I can say is just read, go out, read, take, you know, consider the arguments, look at it. And, you know, obviously what our view of the war, particularly during the war and right after, with the triumphalism, it's all propaganda. And it really is silly because you have these cartoon figures. The Hitler of history is really a cartoonish figure, as we've been given. Yeah. And so any critical thinking going, wait a second, this doesn't seem right. Why would they do this? Why would they do this? You know, why would they engage in this genocidal program in the middle of a two-front war, when their resources are being taxed? It just doesn't seem to make sense. The numbers don't add up. And the fact that to question that narrative will land you in jail in more than two dozen countries, or result in you being fired or having your reputation ruined, your life ruined. It's something wrong about that. But Hitler himself, you're saying, Hitler, took on the globalist powers, and was the last figure to actually defend European power against the globalists. But nevertheless, he was defeated. And when we look at Hitler, it says Hitler ultimately failed. And is that an indictment? He failed to, although let's say by your estimations, his goals were justified, or if not noble, he failed to assess or properly analyze or identify the forces against Germany, and he took the bait, which ultimately led to Germany's destruction. Would that be? Some people would say, well, that's an indictment. His role as a leader. How would you react to that criticism?
Well, he actually resisted the bait again and again and again and again, almost to the point. And he even said this, that some of the concessions that I was willing to make nobody else in Germany would make them. It would be too humiliating for the country. But because he was so loved, he was able to make that. For example, with Poland, even though a huge chunk of Eastern Prussia was stolen from Germany and the people were ethnically cleansed, this is at the end of World War I, they said, okay, this is Poland now. And like 5 million people were told, get the hell out, with the shirt on their back. People were being killed and abused. In spite of all of that, he put on the table, okay, you can keep all that territory. All we want is a 1 mile wide railroad and highway to link Germany to the city, the isolated city of Danzig. They did this crazy rewrite of the map after World War I. So you had Germany, and then all of a sudden it's Poland, territory that was taken from Germany. And then on the other side, there's another enclave or exclave of Germany. But so he was willing to just forget all that. He even turned a blind eye. For months, Germany was complaining about the Germans who were stranded in Poland that were being massacred. There were incursions on the German-Polish border. There was U.S. sinking a German ship. I mean, one insult, humiliation after another, after another, after another. It gets to the point where the war is coming to you anyway, and there's no avoiding it. And that's when Germany made its move into Poland. Poland would have just invaded Germany. I'm not kidding. Okay. And because they were under the delusion that France and England would then come from the West, which they never did, by the way. They kind of sold Poland out. It was a trick.
Yeah, that was so the blank Poland check. Yeah.
Start the war. And they figured later on we'll get the Soviets in the war, but they didn't lift a finger. And Poland was, they say, wait a minute, where are you guys? I mean, that war only lasted a month, but they didn't get any help in the West. I mean, the France, they took a little bit of Germany, and that's it. And then later on, when the Soviets came in from the East, Poland continued to plead with England and France for help. And it's like, sorry, you're on your own. But anyway, it got to the point there was no way that Germany could avoid the war. 100%, it was imposed on Germany. So,
this goes to that 30-year war thesis, where ultimately Germany could not be allowed to be an independent power in the heart of Europe, because that was a challenge to the globalist Atlanticist powers. And it goes back to that whole, you know, controlling.
Yeah, well, in my book, I explained from the very beginning. As soon as the Franco-Prussian War ended in the 1870s, and that's when Germany united. Prior to that, there were like 30 different little federations. Mm-hmm. From that moment, already France and Britain were looking at the situation like, wow, they're going to be a commercial powerhouse, okay? And they were plotting even back then to take out the German nation. And once Germany became united in the subsequent decades, they could outproduce and undersell anybody in the world. Quality of goods, a good price, you know, that's the way the Germans are, you know. Mm-hmm. And it bred a degree of jealousy in the English and French establishment. And again, so you combine that sort of uber nationalism of the French and British with the Jewish banker intrigue, and it made for an evil, deadly formula. To take the war to Germany, there was nothing Hitler could have done to avoid it.
Your book is a good job of spelling it. This goes back decades.
It's critical to understand that they were making war against Germany really in the 1870s. Mm-hmm. So once you see that, I mean, context is everything. You can't pick up a book on World War II and start in 1939. You know, that's absurd.
Yeah, history didn't begin in 1941 or 1939 or 40 for that matter. Right. There's a whole context here. Same thing in Asia.
I actually go back to the 1840s and to the revolutions in Europe and Karl Marx and the Communist Manifesto. That's all relevant. I don't spend too much time on that, but I give you enough. So by the time you get to the big show, you're already in a state of mind like, oh. So it's like a movie. I'm telling you. There's nothing like the bad war. That's why they banned it.
Yeah. I think there was a great, I think it was between Lord Balfour and Lord Grey. I might have the two Brits confused here, but someone said they were talking, this is right before the First World War. maybe a decade before, and they're looking at, you know, the British economic problems. You know, the British Empire is in sort of suffering decline at this point because they're facing what their competition with the Americans and the Germans. And they look at Germany, and well, I think it was one says the other, how do we deal with Germany, you know, economic power? And he says, well, we can always work harder. And the other guy says, now let's just go to war instead.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what, yeah. And so, yeah. So that's what it was. I encourage you to go read the book. It is, it's very visual. I read it, a lot of pictures, bullet points, and you get the big picture idea of this stuff, of that conflict in its full historical context, which changes the sort of the narrative. And as unsettling as it may be to Americans who take pride in winning the good war, it's necessary because look what's happening now. I mean, look what's happened to the United States. It's completely taken over by these internationalists, yeah. You know, which is a product of that conflict. And I know it's hard, you know, the greatest generation went off to war. They came back and they work hard and create a good life for Americans, but we're paying the price for it now for that sort of that, I think the blindness that we have of the willingness for Americans to be fodder for the international bankers goes back to that war where we're told we were great because we went off and fought and won this war. And as your book points out, there's another side of the story to this thing, as there usually is. Yeah, and I do recommend people go and get the book. So listen, I want to thank you for coming back on the show.
All right, Timothy.
And it's it's a great topic. It's very interesting. Again, much more complex and ambiguous than we're led to believe. That's all I can. And it's considering the scope and size of that conflict, it should be just surprising for most people. So so follow your work at the Real History Channel.
It's Real History Chan, CHAN, realhistorychan.com.
Okay.
And it, you know, people should bookmark it. Check out the free excerpt of The Bad War. You'll see a tab up top. And at the very least, sign up for the free report, PDF report I give away. It's called How to Respond to an Anti-Conspiracy Theorist. It gives you all the rebuttals to these people who say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. It's a really good report. It gets you on the mailing list. Also, there's a banned book section. I had 24 books. They were all Holocausted from Amazon, but they're still available either through me as paperback or as PDF. They're all really good. They're rich in illustrations, and they really enhance the learning. You come up the learning curve very quickly. RealHistoryChan.com. If you enjoyed this evening's discussion, wait till you see The Bad War. And Planet Rothschild, too.
Yes. Okay, listen, thank you so much. I'll let you go. And hey, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And we'll talk again soon after the new year, I hope.
Will do. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Okay, good night.